It's time for Security Now. Steve Gibson is here. We have lots to talk about. Why the new Windows subsystem for Linux, WSL, in Windows 10 bypasses the Windows firewall and what you can do about it. Microsoft changing some of the ways it's doing updating, in vitro updating for Defender. We'll talk about Cloudflare's new API protection. And then why is it some people are still using Windows 7? Steve takes a look at Ed Bott's poll of users. It's all coming up next on Security Now. Security Now comes to you from our Twit LastPass studios. Securing every access point in your company does not have to be a challenge. LastPass unifies access and authentication to make securing your employees simple and secure, even when they're working remotely. Check out LastPass.com/twit to learn more.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Security Now with Steve Gibson, episode 787, recorded Tuesday, October 6th, 2020. Why Windows 7 lives on. This episode of Security Now is brought to you by LastPass. LastPass can help you manage identities and promote good security behaviors while your employees are remote. Visit LastPass.com/twit to find out how they can help you. And by Worldwide Technology and Fortinet. When was the last time your company updated your security strategy? Are your business assets protected? WWT offers security solutions and services that will protect every endpoint in your business and help you combat the next-gen threats. Visit WWT.com/twit to get started. And by Melissa. Like expired milk, 30% of your customers' data goes bad every year. That's money down the drain. Visit Melissa's developer portal for free access to data quality APIs, demos, and code samples. Freshen up your sour data today with 1,000 records cleaned for free at melissa.com/twit. It's time for Security Now, the show where we cover your privacy, your security, with this guy right here, Mr. Steve Gibson of the Gibson Research Corporation, creator of SpinRite, and our leader into the world of the dark side of the internet. Hello, Steve.
Yo, Leo.
How are you today?
Great to be with you. Good. Episode 787.
Wow.
For, October 6th.
We're in the airliner series.
It's happening, baby.
Yeah.
So there was a bunch of interesting news. Nothing really stuck out except Ed Bott took a poll a couple of weeks ago over at ZDNet when they were noticing what a large percentage of their visitors were still coming to their site with Windows 7. So we thought, what? Let's ask people why. And I thought that would just be interesting. Certainly, it has a bearing on security, as we know, because the updates terminated at the beginning of this year. Almost 10% of ZDNet's current web visitors are still using Windows 7. So the title of this week's podcast is Why Win 7 Lives On, which I think will be interesting to our listeners. And I was a little surprised until I thought about it. I thought, oh, okay, yeah, that makes sense. So with that tease, we will get to that. But first, we're going to examine several new and welcome Google initiatives aimed at improving Android, sort of in general, and also everybody's web browser security. We're going to look at Microsoft's solution for, which is kind of really interesting and cool, for updating aging offline Windows images with the latest Defender definitions. We're going to look at some surprising network behavior from the Windows second subsystem for Linux, which is where we are now, WSL2. Their re-architecting of it had a side effect that it's catching some people off guard. We're also going to check in on Exchange server updates 8 months downstream of the February patch. And it probably won't surprise any of our listeners to learn that they have not all been updated yet. We're also going to cover Cloudflare's announcement of a very welcome new free web API firewall. Also, the U.S. Treasury has decided to update their policies regarding ransomware payments, and no one's happy about that. Also, and this was probably the most tweeted thing to me over the past week, Kaspersky's discovery of the use of another UEFI bootkit, which always makes all of our listeners nervous. We got a little bit of errata from last week. I'm going to update our listeners about the GRC forums, and then we're going to take a look at the interesting results of this poll that ZDNet conducted. I think it was 3,600 respondents, so a nice, chunky, big sample, and learn why Windows 7 refuses to die.
It's
something not surprising, but some things were.
It's tempting to assume it's kind of stupidity of some kind, or, you know, they're just old and don't want to, you know, change things. But I bet, well, I haven't read it yet, so I'm curious. But I bet it's some better reason than that, I would hope. We shouldn't judge our show.
Indeed. And we do have a programmer's keyboard to show everybody for our picture of the week.
It's probably all escape keys. I haven't looked at it yet, though, so we'll see. Oh, I love it. Our show today, that's coming up. But first, a word from our sponsor. A show today brought to you by our good friends at LastPass. We've got a great LastPass event coming up. You were, you know, just part of our LastPass event last time, and I didn't want to overtax you, Steve. So we have a good panel planned. We're going to do attack and defense, red team, blue team. I will be the white team, the judge, as we have two of the most evil hackers in the world, Father Robert Balasair and his co-host, former co-host from Twiat, Chibert, attacking Gerald Buchelt. Jerry is, as you know, Steve, you've met him, the CISO at LogMeIn, LastPass's parent company. And he'll be teamed up with Bruce Schneier, and they'll be fighting off the attackers. I think it's going to be a lot of fun. That's coming up. Attack and defense. And really, it's not going to really be a competition. What it's really going to be about is how people these days are attacking and what you can do to mitigate it. So it's going to be, I think, a very valuable hour spent this coming Thursday, 1 p.m., thanks to LastPass. We really love LastPass. They are not only a great sponsor, but they have a commitment, and they've had this commitment for the last 12 years to protect users. 25 million users now, 70,000 businesses. That number's doubled since we started talking about LastPass Enterprise less than a year ago, for good reason. It's no surprise they're the number one award-winning password manager, and that, in fact, you know, businesses have jumped on LastPass because all of a sudden, instead of having your employees in the cozy, secure confines of your corporate network, they're out at home on their less than secure network with the passwords to your most valuable assets. There's no question this remote work environment really impacts identity and access management for businesses. And it's not just the logistical problem of sending your employees home. It's the security issue as well. LastPass instantly becoming, you know, I mean, doubling in the number of businesses who use it over less than a year. Really clearly the saving grace to help companies. I know of some case studies, some test cases. I won't name names, but I have to include our own company. We've been using LastPass for ages, for many years. I started it 12 years ago. Steve, you did, I can't even believe it now, it was 10 years ago that you did your review of LastPass with Joe Segrist. We started using LastPass Enterprise more than 5 years ago. Companies leverage LastPass so that their teams can set up and use strong passwords for their accounts and the programs. But it goes beyond that. LastPass Enterprise now has single sign-on, more than 1,300 apps, which is kind of a nice solution. You know, passwords are not a great solution. Single sign-on makes it easier for employees, more convenient, and more secure for you. LastPass can help you transition your remote workforce if you haven't done so already with single sign-on, with enterprise management. And of course, one of the things that's always first and foremost with LastPass is that your IT department has oversight with shadow IT. They can enforce policies. There's more than 100 policies they can enforce across their accounts. We enforce a number of them. For instance, we require all our employees use two-factor. We have minimum password requirements so that they'll use strong passwords. I mean, they've really dotted all the I's and crossed all the T's. There's multi-factor, not just two-factor, but multi-factor authentication. So, of course, you've got biometrics. LastPass supports fingerprinting, face recognition, even iris recognition on hardware that supports it. But they go a step beyond that with contextual factors like IP address or geolocation. Because let's face it, the most important feature of LastPass for you is the assurance that the right employees are accessing resources they're supposed to have access to and not that they're not at the right time from the right location. And it's really what we've called before a zero knowledge security model. It protects everybody from the individual user to the biggest organization that uses LastPass. It's worth saying again, your security is their top priority. LastPass is beloved by employees because it's more convenient. It's the first thing I install on any device I use. It's where I store my most valuable stuff, not just passwords, but passports and driver's licenses and social security numbers. It's like a secure enclave because my password vault, my secure storage is never decrypted anywhere but on device. My master password that's used to decrypt it along with my second factor authentication, I use a YubiKey. The password's never transmitted to LastPass. They never have access to it. They use AES 256-bit encryption. We've talked about this before, Steve, to prevent brute forcing the LastPass vault. They use PBKDF2. You can set the iterations, but I think the default is now 100,000 iterations. It's a ton of iterations. They, of course, use SHA 256 and salted hashes. Everything is done right so that you can sleep at night, frankly. LastPass has now won 8 awards, and that's just this year. PC Magazine's Editor's Choice, the Fortress Cybersecurity Award, Business Insider's Best Overall Password Manager. LastPass speaks for itself, and we will all be speaking about it this Thursday, 1 p.m. Join us for that very special panel of security experts. There's no better time to get LastPass. Ease the burden. Make it easier for you to go to sleep at night. and protect your remote workforce with the cyber protection you need. Go to lastpass.com/twit. That's lastpass.com/twit. This is a good picture of the week. I like it.
So I had seen it once before, and it struck me as just fun. So this is, for those who don't have video, this is showing us the Supercoder 2000, which it has the subtitle Air-Cooled Coding Keyboard for Professional Use. And because this is about programming, it has exactly 3 buttons, a 0, a 1, and a done.
That's all you need.
Because one presumes that the fingers will be flying. It's got very prominent air vents to allow it to air cool, because that keyboard would tend to overheat otherwise from all the zeros and ones being pumped into it. And we're sort of used to 3D models and rendering these days. This thing looks real. I mean, I think
somebody
it's
built this for sure. Somebody built this for sure.
Yeah. 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 So that's like, okay, good.
I'm not saying somebody used it, but they definitely built it.
Yeah. You can enter a 0 or 1, or and you can declare when you're done. So basically, that sums it up. So Google is going to be getting even more proactive about Android security. We know that Google runs their own bug bounty program for Android apps, which are those listed in the Play Store, the ones that they're curating. That program is called the Google Play Security Reward Program, not a very catchy abbreviation, GPSRP, Google Play Security Reward Program. And through that program, Independent security researchers are rewarded for locating and responsibly reporting bugs they find in Play Store Android apps. So Google is in essence paying for bug submissions on behalf of its platform apps publishers. But one limitation of the GPSRP is that it's restricted to major apps having more than 100 million users. So I guess Google is saying, look, guys, you know, there's a lot of apps there, and don't go, you know, finding some bug in an obscure app that 12 people have downloaded. While we would like to have that fixed, we're not that concerned about it. And you're not going to get a bounty for that. So the GPSRP, 100 million users minimum. But Google noticed that other apps that handle sensitive data may be performing critical tasks and don't meet that 100 million threshold that would make them ineligible for GPSRP rewards and are therefore less likely to be tested by external bug hunters. So what happened was some sharp-eyed person noted a job posting that went online last Wednesday in which Google wrote, quote, "As a security engineering manager in Android security, your team will perform application security assessments against highly sensitive third-party Android apps on Google Play, working to identify vulnerabilities and provide remediation guidance to impacted application developers." And according to Sebastian Porst, who is the software engineering manager for Google Play Protect, this new team will be focused on apps such as COVID-19 contact tracing and election-related applications, with others to follow. In their coverage of this event, ZDNet quoted Lucas Stefanko, a mobile malware analyst at security firm ESET. Lucas said that it was definitely a good move, and also that finding security issues with serious impact isn't that easy and requires a lot of time and experience. So to Google's credit, having a dedicated team ensures that some of the world's best security talent and will put their focus and effort into looking at apps that might otherwise slip under the radar and could end up being exploited with serious consequences. So anyway, just Google, again, doing good things for the community. And, you know, we see a lot of that on, like, from our view of Google. I know that it's controversial. There was some brouhaha recently that erupted in some dialogue over on GRC's forums because I'm using ReCAPTCHA, which, of course, is Google's CAPTCHA anti-bot solution. And people were objecting to the fact that, you know, Google is Google. But, you know, from our perspective here, Google's doing a lot of work to keep things secure. And in fact, they are also going to be funding a JavaScript research engine, or essentially offering grants for people. They've established a new grant program to fund research aimed at locating bugs in the industry's browsers' JavaScript engines. Excuse me. The eligible targets are Google's Chrome V8 engine, Firefox's SpiderMonkey, and the Safari JavaScript Core, each which are the JavaScript processing engines for those browsers. And they did indicate that other engines could be picked and pitched in a grant proposal, but we'll see for a minute why those three make the most sense. So this program will help and sponsor security researchers and academics to find vulnerabilities hidden inside any of those three JavaScript engines. And the program only has one rule. The bugs must be identified through fuzzing. And we've talked about the virtues and value and power of fuzzing many times in the past. However, since fuzzing tends to be an extremely resource-intensive process, it's traditionally been the province of larger tech organizations that can afford the resources required to set up comprehensive fuzzing operations. To be done at scale, it typically employs large and expensive cloud computing, resources that are typically beyond the reach of most solo researchers working on their own in the hope of finding a significant bug. And of course, the cloud resources needed to be paid or need to be paid for, whether or not there's any follow-on bug bounty payoff. And even when bounties are paid, it can be months later, if at all. So in their blog post last Thursday, Google said it created this research grant to address exactly these problems. Under Google's new pilot program, which will have a one-year duration, is October 1st, last Thursday, to October 1st of 2021. Security researchers and academics can apply for the funds required to fuzz any of those three JavaScript engines. Google said it will analyze each grant proposal submission and provide an answer to all applicants within 2 weeks, with approved projects receiving up to $5,000 in funding. Now, naturally, since Google is a provider of exactly such cloud services themselves, might as well keep the money in the family. The grant funding will actually be up to $5,000 in credits to be used on Google's compute engine, which is their heavy computing infrastructure in the cloud. So it runs, as I said, from October 1st, 2020 through 2021. And they're calling the program the Fuzzily Research Grant, or Fuzzily, you know, obviously a play on a pasta, right? F-U-Z-Z-I-L-L-I, named after Google's own Fuzzily open source fuzzing tool, which supports distributed fuzzing on the Google Compute Engine. And, of course, Google naturally encourages grant recipients to use. I guess the $5,000 cloud computing grant credit wouldn't do you any good unless you were going to use it on Google's Compute Engine, which is the only place you can use it. Although Google said that all bugs identified during the pilot program must be reported to the affected vendors, researchers may retain any bug bounty payoffs themselves for any bugs they might find during the program. Samuel Grobe, the creator of Fuzzily and a member of Google's Project Zero team, said, quote, "JavaScript engine security continues to be critical for user safety, as demonstrated by recent in-the-wild zero-day exploits abusing vulnerabilities in Chrome's V8 JavaScript engine." So I think this is neat. If, for example, any of our listeners might have some time on their hands during the COVID mess or just during spare time on evenings and weekends, you could figure out how Fuzzily works. It's all posted. It's open source. It's there on GitHub. Play with it on your own machine to work out the details and you know, come up with an idea. Then apply to Google for a $5,000 grant to scale its use up to big cloud iron level. And if you were to get lucky with fuzzing essentially for free using Google's cloud infrastructure, you might uncover a previously unknown and valuable flaw, and then you could score yourself some cash without incurring any other out-of-pocket expenses. I've got the various links to the announcement and to its presence on GitHub for anyone who's interested. Samuel's blog posting about this added, he said, submissions are not limited to those in academia or those with a demonstrated track record of success. If you have a good idea in this space, we'd love to hear from you. Incoming submissions will be reviewed by a review board on a regular basis, and we aim to respond to every submission within 2 weeks. If the project is accepted, the researchers may be awarded GCE, that's Google's cloud engine, or Google's compute engine, credits worth up to $5,000. Researchers can also apply for multiple grants throughout the lifetime of the project. The grants come with the following requirements, he wrote. The credits must be used for fuzzing JavaScript engines with the approach described in the proposal. The fuzzed JavaScript engines should be one or more of the following: JavaScript Core for Safari, V8 for Chrome and Edge, and remember, any other Chromium-based browsers, or SpiderMonkey used by Firefox. And when I went over to take a look at and remind myself about Fuzili, because we talked about it before, I saw that it was those three engines for which there is already prepared interfacing open source glue, essentially. So using those three would be far easier with Fuzili, although you could certainly do something else if you wanted to bite that off and then propose that to Google. Samuel said all vulnerabilities found must be only reported to the affected vendor, meaning, you know, responsibly and privately. Researchers are encouraged to apply Project Zero's 90-day disclosure policy. Researchers may claim any CVE credits and bug bounty payouts for reporting the bugs that don't conflict with the following requirements. He said, any newly developed source code must be published under an open source license that permits future or further research by others. So, for example, if you did bring up support for some different browser's JavaScript engine, then that needs to be part of your contribution to the open source community. He said, an interim report for Google only at the conclusion of the fuzzing to demonstrate the initial results of the research so that we can determine the efficacy of the research and make our folks in accounting happy. So justify the $5,000 that got burned somehow. Furthermore, a final report of some form, for example, a conference paper, a blog post, or standalone PDF, due no later than 6 months after the first grant for a project has been awarded, including a detailed explanation of the project, basic statistics about which engines have been fuzzed for how long, CPU time, iterations, etc., and a clear technical explanation of all vulnerabilities discovered throughout the project. And he concludes, researchers are encouraged to base their project on the open source, oh, here he's just talking about the Fuzili fuzzer, if possible. You know, he's the guy who wrote it, so yeah, he liked to see it used also, which is ready to go on Google's compute engine. So, again, a very cool opportunity. If there are any of our listeners who think this might apply to them, I would suggest you think about it. Grab Fuzili, play with it, figure it out, see if it makes sense, and then go for a grant. You could end up having a CVE to your name and maybe a bug bounty payment. This I thought was really interesting. And, you know, props to Microsoft. Microsoft is giving Defender what I described as in vitro updating. Many enterprise environments used a fixed image of Windows, which they downloaded from Microsoft at some point, to set up their new workstations. And these images are often used for many months at a time. We know that enterprise especially wants to hold on to a given install image as long as they can. The last thing they want to be doing is like spreading, you know, smearing, to use the word I have before, various major feature builds of Windows 10 across their enterprise. They really behooves them to keep them synced. So as a consequence, a static image of some instance of Windows 10 would be used for a long time. And, you know, there's really no point in updating to a newer download of the same image since it's just going to be the same download. Microsoft isn't changing those over time. But that's the problem. The trouble is that these images are aging, and so is their built-in Windows Defender definitions, which were frozen at the time that that image was created, making Windows Defender, as is built in, less and less relevant because it's aging too. And it won't know about any of the newer threats that have been discovered and added to the current Defender AV definitions. And yes, it's true that after the image has been deployed onto a new machine and that machine has gone online, downloaded everything that has happened in the Windows world since that original image was downloaded and frozen, then those are updated and the system is rebooted, then yes, it too will have caught up and had the latest and greatest. But the problem, in Microsoft's words, is that that still leaves a potentially significant protection gap, which is the term they used, during which a machine that's booted up and running and on the network could have some seriously outdated Defender definitions until it can update itself. So to close this protection gap, on Friday, Microsoft released a new tool for both 32 and 64-bit systems that allows an up-to-the-minute version of Windows Defender to be inserted into an offline WIM or VHD Windows image, thus bringing the image's AV awareness current before it's being used to create any running systems. I've got their annoying links with a link ID. I've got them both in the show notes for anyone who's interested at the bottom of page 3. Those links point to zip files, each which contains two files, an updated and continually updated WindowsDefender.cab file and a PowerShell script, which is named DefenderUpdateWinImage.ps1. So there's also a link to an upper-level announcement, Microsoft Defender Update for Windows Operating System Installation Images, in the show notes, that would take you to a page explaining how to use those zips and to deploy. But I think it's very cool. It allows you to take, you know, a standard Windows install and in vitro insert the latest Defender into it so that at the moment it comes up, it is, and like boots, even before it's had a chance to update everything else, it is up to the minute updated with Defender things. And as we know, especially this year, that's become more important than ever because there have been lots of critical things, which, you know, I mean, it's how what we've been spending a lot of time recently talking about is that people are not applying these updates in as timely a fashion as necessary. And there are threats in the wild that are taking advantage of these. So, again, props to Microsoft for getting ahead of this. I mentioned at the top a change that had been made in Windows subsystem for Linux version 2. It turns out that it quietly, completely bypasses its hosting machine's Windows 10 firewall, which is new behavior. I wanted to make sure that none of our listeners would get caught out by this. The first version of Windows subsystem for Linux, WSL1, was implemented using a Linux emulating pseudokernel that translated Linux system calls into their equivalent WinNT kernel calls. So under WSL1, any network traffic would actually be coming from Windows. That is, any Linux-sourced network traffic would actually be coming from Windows and is thereby filtered through the standard built-in Windows application firewall. The Linux distro honors any configured rules because it's behind that firewall, because it's also actually behind the Windows kernel. But with the second release, the second iteration, and it was a huge change, WSL2 does everything differently. In WSL2, Microsoft produced a true Linux kernel operating side by side with Windows in a Hyper-V virtual machine and a Hyper-V virtual network adapter. As a consequence of this complete re-architecting, it's a completely different architecture. So unlike with WSL1, WSL2 traffic is sent directly to the virtual network adapter, completely bypassing the Windows firewall. So this is not in itself a bad thing. I would argue it's way more powerful and it's cleaner, and that this architecture is correct. It means you've got Linux and Windows side by side rather than this first pass kludge that they created. But it does mean that an unwary user might mistakenly assume that they had the same merged Windows firewall protection after updating themselves and their system to WSL2, and that's not the case. So they could be inadvertently left exposed. So anyway, just beware that there is no Windows firewall protecting WSL2 instances of Linux. It is out there on the raw network adapter, and so subject to any incoming that the Windows application firewall before was protecting. So, of course, you know, Linux is where the internet, well, Unix actually, was where the internet was born. And so it's got firewalls and filters and network protection galore. But you need to turn it on if that's what you're expecting to have. And speaking of things not being patched for quite some length of time, we talked about this at the time. On February 11th, 2020, Microsoft released security updates to address a vulnerability in Microsoft Exchange Server that would allow an attacker to turn any stolen Exchange user account into a complete system compromise. In many implementations, this could be used to completely compromise the entire Exchange environment, including all email and potentially Active Directory itself, giving bad guys complete access into a system. That was February 11th, which was Patch Tuesday in February. A month later, any admins who were paying attention would have subsequently learned that any still unpatched servers were then being exploited in the wild by unnamed APT, Advanced Persistent Threat Actors. So what's the story today? 8 months from the time that the patch was released. Somewhat unbelievably, Rapid7 conducted a survey on September 21st and found that out of 433,464, okay, so 433,464 open and internet-facing Exchange servers. Of course, that's what Exchange server is supposed to be, right? It's email. It's going to be out there on the public internet. 433,464 could be observed on the internet. On September 21st, at least 61% of Exchange 2010, 2013, 2016, and 2019 servers have remained vulnerable to the flaw despite there having been offered an update. And this flaw, this vulnerability is not theoretical, you know, like Spectre and Meltdown. This is known to be exploited in the wild. You know, we moan and we groan and we feel rightly sorry when large enterprises are stuck, for example, by debilitating or struck by debilitating ransomware, having their information exfiltrated, being publicly shamed, having their users' data put at risk of exposure, and often needing to pay a hefty ransom. But when you learn that, and this is the count, 267,986 individual exchange servers still remain vulnerable to remote exploitation today, 8 months after a patch to close this vulnerability has been made available, well, you know, no one deserves to be illegally attacked. It's still illegal, but wearing a sign that says "kick me" is known to be asking for it. And you know, any enterprise that, and there's 267,000, almost 268,000 individual exchange servers 8 months from the patch availability still exploitable. It's just crazy. And although it isn't, you know, it isn't a simple vulnerability where you know, like a problem with RDP where you can simply get in without authentication, it's a clearly and rightfully a privilege escalation or elevation. You need to have an exchange account, but it's a perfect example of the idea of someone getting in, doing some reconnaissance, watching the system that they're on, looking at traffic. It would not be difficult to do keystroke logging and capture exchange credentials or monitor a workstation's traffic and get credentials. As soon as you have any credential on that exchange server, then it can be used to potentially get you access to that network's Active Directory. And as we were just talking about last week, that's the keys to the kingdom, then essentially giving you access to much more on that network, allowing a bad guy then to move laterally and get to all the machines there. So again, it's like, you know, how can it be that, I mean, these must just be completely administratively abandoned exchange servers or people who aren't paying attention to the fact. I mean, I guess there's, for our listeners, there's just nothing could be more clear today than that with the use of software comes the need to keep it current. It is, you know, a obvious truth that is constantly being reinforced by what we see now every day. And Leo, I'm going to take a sip of water here.
All right.
Let's talk about our second sponsor.
Well, I would prefer to talk about patching cadence, but okay, if you insist, we'll. Actually, it's kind of related. Our show today brought to you by our friends at Worldwide Technology. You were a topic of conversation when we were out there in St. Louis in March, my last trip. We went and visited the Advanced Technology Center. Lots of fans out there for this show. And, of course, Worldwide Technology is all about security. They're the number one, in my book anyway, provider of enterprise solutions. They've partnered with Fortinet, a name I know you know. Yep. WWT offers security solutions and services that will protect your business. Attackers have updated their strategy. Have you noticed? Have you? WWT will help your organization prepare and combat those next-gen threats. You're looking for a company, I would guess, that has the vision, the services, the skills, the capabilities needed to deliver those security controls, reduce the risk for your organization. In fact, in their studies, patch cadence came up a lot. People just don't patch. They worked with a large healthcare organization. They did a security risk assessment, which is, I think, probably a legal requirement of their certified electronic health record technology. This is something everybody's moving to, but you've got to make sure you're protecting the privacy of your patients. WWT's consultants came in. They used their expert knowledge. They used state-of-the-art tools. They really did an in-depth analysis. And then, using training and repetition. They completed their assessment. And here's the number that you'll like, Steve. Kind of confirms what you were just saying. 90% of the vulnerabilities they found at this healthcare organization could be fixed by just putting in a comprehensive, systematic approach in place for patching. Thing is, if you don't do the assessment, you don't know what the problem is. You can't just say, hey, patch everybody. You got to do the assessment. That's why WWT is so great. You want somebody with some real expertise, somebody who's done this before, time and time again. They know exactly what corners to look in, who to talk to, and then how to remediate. They worked with a retail bank to help them achieve their goal, which was establishing an infrastructure that could survive a catastrophic cybersecurity event. But that's your goal, too. WWT helped them reduce system outages by 40%. And by the way, it saves the money, an ongoing cost savings of 48%, because they introduced infrastructure automation. When you get WWT's trained eyes on your situation, they can help. They can make a huge difference. Their team provides resources and platforms that can deliver security controls, reduce the risk for your organization, and that comes from 3 decades of experience. They've got the track record to help you succeed. But don't think they sit on their laurels. I almost hate to say 3 decades. It's not that, you know, oh, they were really expert in the 90s. I've never seen an organization that devotes more energy to thinking about systems, to improving their systems, to staying up to date on the state of the art. Just take a look at their Advanced Technology Center with $500 million worth of enterprise gear in there. That's where the engineers not just train, but spin up proofs of concept. They can offer a variety of security solutions and services that will really lock your business down. They'll help you with security strategy with a holistic approach. So they consider your business goals and objectives. See, a lot of times I think management says, well, wait a minute. You know, we're not going to just spend. This has to match our organizational objectives. Well, they'll do that. They can reduce the risk for your organization at the same time as they honor your business goals. They can provide endpoint security. Gosh knows we need that. Those endpoints now are out in people's houses. Improving visibility and compliance while defending at the edge. There's network security. They can protect all your network traffic, decrease your attack surface, improve threat detection and response. By the way, threats happen, attacks happen. Response is what really matters. And combining all those factors, they can reduce your overall cyber risk. Of course, they do identity and access management. We talk about that all the time, ensuring the right people have the access to the right devices and resources, and no one else. If you're looking for a zero trust architecture, that's the latest. That's what Google started doing, and that's what everybody wants to do now. They know how to do that. They can help you build your next generation security architecture based on strong identity management, encryption, and segmentation, and even micro-segmentation to thwart the most advanced attacks. And, of course, your security operations will benefit by getting WWT in there. You can combine event correlation along with automation and orchestration to increase visibility, reduce dwell time, eliminate risk where it matters the most. Look, it's true. No matter what field you work in, security is job 1, maybe job 2, 3, and 4 as well. See how WWT can protect your business assets and intellectual property with a holistic security approach. Go to WWT.com/twit to get started. Worldwide technology. Go to WWT.com/twit. We thank WWT for their partnership and for what they can offer you. WWT.com/twit. Worldwide technology, delivering outcomes, digital outcomes, and modernizing IT infrastructure all over the world. Back to you, Steve.
So,
are you laughing at
Cloudflare?
Are you laughing at my enthusiasm?
No. With me. Our friends at Cloudflare just added a free web API firewall service for all of their customers.
Oh.
Very cool. Last Thursday, they announced their new API Shield. I've got a link to the blog posting, which announces it in the show notes. They start out by explaining APIs are the lifeblood of modern internet-connected applications. Every millisecond, they carry requests from mobile applications. Place this food delivery order. Like this picture. and directions to IoT devices, unlock the car door, start the wash cycle. My human just finished a 5K run, among countless other calls. They said they're also the target of widespread attacks designed to perform unauthorized actions or exfiltrate data, as data from Gartner increasingly shows. Quoting Gartner, they said, by 2021, 90% of web-enabled applications will have more surface area for attack in the form of exposed APIs rather than the UI, up from 40% in 2019. And Gartner predicted that by 2022, API abuses will move from an infrequent to the most frequent attack vector, resulting in data breaches for enterprise applications. Of the 18 million requests per second that traverse Cloudflare's network, 50% are directed towards APIs, with the majority of these requests blocked as malicious. So just to sort of back up a little bit, a perfect example of a web API, just to kind of give our listeners some context, that we've talked about not too long ago, was the SS API. That was the Squirrel Service Provider API that I designed and created for Rasmus to use when he created the Squirrel client for Zenforo. I didn't want to burden him with the need to learn anything about how Squirrel works. And I realized that this would also be a general boon for Squirrel's server-side adopters. So I hid and encapsulated all of Squirrel's various details behind a very simple abstract authentication API. It was accessible through a simple HTTP query and reply, and in that way, Rasmus could simply post HTTP queries using any web agent, in this case PHP, and receive meaningful replies. And this is the model that's evolving for the entire industry. It allows for the creation of elegant and clean interfaces. And in the Squirrel use case, I was able to make the interface private, since it only needed to support transactions between Rasmus's PHP code and mine, both which resided on the same server or also on the same network. But the case with Cloudflare, the case that Cloudflare is addressing requires much more security, since, as the Gartner group notes, most of these APIs need to be publicly available. So, you know, so like with the web and communications, what we're now beginning to see is, once upon a time, it was a browser being viewed by a human that was pulling content from a web server. Increasingly, it's, well, I mean, a perfect example I was talking about just recently when I added IoT gizmos. You know, I have now an IoT thermostat, which is setting the temperature for the room I'm in, and an IoT hygrometer, which is measuring temperature and humidity. Those are definitely communicating using web APIs to their cloud providers in China. And while I'm happy to have them do that, it is the potential abuse of those which would open an opportunity for them to be exploited on my network, which again is why they are sequestered on a network that, where if anything were to get loose, it couldn't damage the rest of my network. Okay, so Cloudflare continued their announcement by saying, to combat these threats, Cloudflare is making it simple to secure APIs through the use of strong client certificate-based identity, which is, I'll just say, very cool, and, they said, strict schema-based validation. As of today, these capabilities are available free for all plans within our new API Shield offering. And as of today, the security benefits also extend to gRPC-based APIs, which use binary formats such as protocol buffers rather than JSON, and have been growing in popularity with our customer base. So I'll just note that they've implemented a proper deny all model that only permits valid formatted API calls to pass. So they explained a positive security, which is what they called it, a positive security model is one that allows only known behavior and identities while rejecting everything else. It's the opposite of the traditional negative security model enforced by a web application firewall that allows everything except for requests coming from problematic IPs, ASNs, countries, or requests with problematic signatures, like SQL injection attempts. They said implementing a positive security model for APIs is the most direct way to eliminate the noise of credential stuffing attacks and other automated scanning tools. And the first step towards a positive model is deploying strong authentication, such as mutual TLS authentication, which is not vulnerable to reuse or sharing of passwords. And I'll just note that, for example, once Cloudflare deploys this, once people with web APIs enable that and are enabled to enable it, then, for example, Shodan would no longer see any of this. That would just go dark. You would not be discoverable or listable by Shodan. And, of course, that's what you want. You don't want to be seen. And it's not because you've chosen to change your port and you're using an unknown port, which can still be discovered. It's because you're saying we're going to do mutual TLS authentication and have both ends affirmatively acknowledged. So they said, just, this is Cloudflare speaking, just as we simplified the issuance of server certificates back in 2014 with universal SSL, API Shield reduces the process of issuing client certificates to clicking a few buttons in the Cloudflare dashboard. By providing a fully hosted private public key infrastructure, PKI, you can focus on your applications and features rather than operating and securing your own certificate authority. So in other words, they're making it trivial and free to for users of their services to issue their own client certificates, which would then be known to their own CA. So then you put this certificate in your devices that you want to authenticate to the web API which Cloudflare is hosting. When that certificate is presented as part of the TLS handshake, it will be verified. It'll be tied to your account, to your specific API permissions, and it will have been signed by their CA, so it will be valid. They said, once developers can be sure that only legitimate clients with SSL certificates in hand are connecting to their APIs, the next step in implementing a positive security model is making sure that those clients are making valid requests. Extracting a client certificate from a device and reusing elsewhere is difficult but not impossible. So it's also important to make sure that the API is being called as intended. In other words, they recognize that yes, creating client-based certificates is strong security, but it's possible, in theory, to extract the certificate. For example, if it was my residential thermostat making certificate authenticated queries, well, it's sitting, you know, in people's homes. You can buy one from Amazon. You know, it's very much like we talked a long time ago about how it's impossible to actually encrypt DVDs that cannot be decrypted, that cannot have the decryption keys discovered, because the decryption keys have to be in the DVD player that the consumer has, which means you can't hide them perfectly. Anyway, so Cloudflare, of course, recognizes this. They say requests containing extraneous input may not have been anticipated by the APA, by the API developer, and can cause problems if processed directly by the app. So these should be dropped at the edge if possible. API schema validation works by matching the contents of API requests, the query parameters that come after the URL, and contents of the post body against a contract or schema that contains the rules for what is expected. If validation fails, the API call is blocked, protecting the origin from any invalid request or any malicious payload. They said schema validation is currently in closed beta for JSON payloads with gRPC protocol buffer support on the roadmap. If you would like to join the beta, please open a support ticket with the subject API Schema Validation Beta. After the beta has ended, we plan to make schema validation available as part of the API Shield user interface. So this is way cool. Their announcement continues with a demonstration and examples of API schema definitions that explicitly define valid query formats, which are used to drive their query validation firewall. So once again, Cloudflare is innovating and leading the way with some powerful protections for their customers, to which I say bravo. And note, this is exactly the kind of thing that you would like to have in front of your potentially vulnerable API backend. Fuzzing on the outside would simply be blocked by this firewall, because fuzzing is all about throwing unexpected weird stuff at an API, and when it crashes, you go, ooh, and then that gives you a place to look to figure out how and why it crashed, and then go from there. But with something like this, which is doing a, which is checking any inbound arguments against the schema that the developer defined, even if their own API doesn't enforce it, this drops those things, as Cloudflare said, at the edge. They go no further. They are just ignored. And you don't even look at the bandwidth of all that stuff coming in. You just don't see it any longer. So, the more I think about what Cloudflare is doing, the more I think, I may have them in my own future. As we know, I'm still maintaining a full height rack of physical servers and network equipment in a nearby level 3 data center. And I'm reminded that 3 years ago, while I was attending a DigiCert customer advisory board meeting in Utah, I happened to mention GRC's rack of equipment. A bunch of the networking gurus turned toward me as one and with sort of a look of puzzled brow furrowing. Yeah,
look at the caveman over there.
One of them said, yeah, exactly. And I was the oldster in the group. And one of them said, what? No one does hardware anymore.
Yeah.
And I said, oh, I guess I am old school. but I took their point. And at some point in the future, when it no longer makes sense for GRC to have a rack of equipment at level 3, but before I'm ready to abandon GRC.com, we're all getting older, Leo. I'll likely move it to the cloud.
Yeah.
And Cloudflare would probably be my first choice for, GRC's final home. And it would just make sense. So anyway, these guys just keep doing good things and offering very useful services, just a palette of more and more useful services.
It's impressive, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So the U.S. Department of the Treasury has tightened up on ransomware payments, and I'm not sure how I feel about this. I mean, I understand it, but it's, easy for them to do. Last Thursday, the U.S. Treasury Department issued revised guidelines, which, among other things, are targeting this new phenomenon of ransomware negotiators and actually also their insurers. I've got a link to their sort of snapshot policy and also I think it was a 5-page PDF. So in their little snapshot, they said, the U.S. Department of the Treasury's Office of Foreign Assets Control, that's OFAC, which also sounds a little bit like an
OFAC.
Anyway,
yeah.
OFAC.
Oh.
OFAC.
OFAC.
Anyway, they're issuing an advisory to alert companies that engage with victims of ransomware attacks, right? So an alert, they're alerting the companies that engage with victims of ransomware attacks. So that would be the negotiators and the insurers of the potential sanctions risks for facilitating ransomware payments. They said, this advisory highlights OFAC's designations of malicious cyber actors and those who facilitate ransomware transactions under its cyber-related sanctions program. It identifies U.S. government resources for reporting ransomware attacks and provides information on the factors OFAC generally considers when determining an appropriate enforcement response to an apparent violation, such as the existence, nature, and adequacy of a sanctions compliance program. The advisory also encourages financial institutions and other companies that engage with victims of ransomware attacks to report such attacks to and fully cooperate with law enforcement, as these will be considered significant mitigating factors. So the 5-page PDF goes into all the details. But effectively, the Treasury Department wants to be notified of ransomware attacks because large sums of money are crossing U.S. borders and potentially moving into the hands of sanctioned individuals, teams, or governments. And the presumption is that, I got a kick out of this, when notified, Treasury will simply say no. A Treasury official asked about this specifically, said that, quote, license applications involving ransomware payments demanded as a result of malicious cyber-enabled activities will be reviewed by OFAC on a case-by-case basis with a presumption of denial. In other words, you're supposed to get a license application to make such payment, and OFAC will probably say no, unquote. So this really puts victims, their negotiators, and their insurers in an awkward hot seat position, especially when circumstances might strongly compel the victim to want to pay the ransom, and to take advantage of various intermediaries and insurers. So this whole thing is rapidly becoming a hot mess, as people now say these days. And in what was probably the most tweeted event of the week, UEFI boot kits. I was tempted to say they're becoming more mainstream, but I don't think they are. The very first UEFI boot kit was spotted by ESET just over 2 years ago. We covered it here at the time. Their posting at their site, welivesecurity.com, was titled Lojax, First UEFI Rootkit Found in the Wild, Courtesy of the SEDNIT Group. And if those words and terms sound familiar, it's because, 2 years ago we talked about it. 2 years ago, ESET's write-up started off by explaining this a little bit. They said UEFI rootkits are widely viewed as extremely dangerous tools for implementing cyber attacks, as they are hard to detect and able to survive security measures such as operating system reinstallation and even a hard disk replacement. Some UEFI rootkits have been presented as proof of concepts. Some are known to be at the disposal of at least some governmental agencies. However, no UEFI rootkit has ever been detected in the wild until we, ESET, discovered a campaign by the SEDNIT APT group that successfully deployed a malicious UEFI module onto a victim's system. So that was 2 years ago. Today, UEFI rootkits are back in the news thanks to some research findings from Kaspersky. Kaspersky's 30-page PDF is titled Mosaic Regressor, Lurking in the Shadows of UEFI. And that 30-page PDF is not a fluff piece. It drops right into the technology that they found and reverse engineered. So what we know, thanks to Kaspersky's research, is that a Chinese-speaking hacking group has been observed using a UEFI bootkit to download and install additional malware on targeted computers. Fortunately, UEFI firmware attacks remain rare because getting malicious code into the motherboard's firmware remains difficult. Attackers still need either physical access to the machine or they need to compromise the target through some sort of complex supply chain attack where the UEFI firmware or tools that work with UEFI firmware are modified to insert malicious code. So again, not trivial. This is not some, you know, email worm. Kaspersky's malware researchers said they investigated some suspicious systems and discovered malicious code inside those systems' UEFI firmware. The code, and I thought this was kind of cool, was designed to install, or really copy, and reinstall or recopy a malicious app as a Windows auto-run program after every computer restart. So even if the program was found and removed, the next system boot, it would reappear. It would go into the auto-start directory and auto-run when Windows was started. So that auto-run program acts as a downloader for some other malware components, which Kaspersky named the Mosaic Regressor malware framework. They said it had, that they had not yet obtained and analyzed all of Mosaic Regressor's components, but the one they did look at contained functionality to gather all the documents from the recent documents folder, put them into a password-protected archive, and presumably prepare the files for exfiltration via some other component. Of course, it's typically not difficult to get something out of a system that's been compromised, especially if you are password-protecting an archive and it's a well-designed archiver, then it'll be, as we know, maximum entropy noise, not subject to being discovered by anything that might be scanning it on the way out. If you had time, you could even send it out in little, ping echo requests a little bit at a time, because the payload of a ping can be, I think it's up to a kbit of, or maybe it's a kbyte of stuff. Anyway, the researchers found the UEFI bootkit on only two physical systems, but they had found this Mosaic Regressor component on many other computers. Kaspersky believed that the targets of these attacks were all very carefully selected. They were all diplomatic entities and NGOs located in Africa, Asia, and Europe. So that's certainly not random. They wrote, "Based on the affiliation of the discovered victims, we could determine that all had some connection to the DPRK, North Korea, be it nonprofit activity related to the country or actual presence within it. And Kaspersky also discovered that the malicious UEFI code wasn't exactly new. According to their analysis, the code was based on Vector EDK, which is a hacking utility to attack UEFI firmware created by a now-defunct Italian vendor of hacking tools, exploits, and surveillance software that was known as Hacking Team. And I remember when this happened, we talked about it at the time because we joked that quote, Hacking Team was hacked. That's what happened. Hacking Team were themselves hacked back in 2015, and their tools, including this Vector EDK toolkit, were all dumped online. According to Vector EDK's manual, the tool was designed to be used with physical access to a victim's computer. So that happened somehow for these well-placed specific PCs that had this rootkit EDK installed. Kaspersky says that based on the similarities between Vector EDK and the modified version used by the Chinese group, most likely deployed their tool using physical access to their target's computers as well. So same modus. So we don't have some new pernicious UEFI attack vector. It remains blessedly difficult to get malware down into our PC motherboards. But we can also see that a sufficiently determined actor, especially one with state-sponsored control, and for that matter, what contemporary motherboard doesn't have some components sourced from China, is able to pull off such an attack. So I got a lot of tweets about this, like, another UEFI rootkit. It's like, yeah, but boy, you know, it's nothing that is going to get any of us. It's the kind of thing that really high-end, elite systems are going to have installed on them, and it requires a lot of planning and forethought to make that happen. I have a piece of errata which appeared in the GRC news groups, and I looked for it again, and I couldn't find it. But fortunately, Ian Butterworth tweeted to me. He said, "Correction required. Dr. John Campbell is not an MD doctor. He's a retired nurse with a PhD, and he says, see his YouTube about." And Ian said, yes, his content is excellent. I've been watching him for some time. So I did want to correct the record. We mentioned John Campbell last week with that YouTube piece where he was talking about I'm slipping my mind, the vitamin D content, or the amount of vitamin D that and this is the doctor I know him really
Fauci?
Well, but I can't think of it. Fauci, yes, Fauci? Thank you, Dr. Fauci's vitamin D consumption. Thank you, Leo.
Fauci.
Anyway, so John Campbell knows his stuff. It's clear from watching his YouTube videos. But not medical doctor, PhD doctor. So thank you, everybody, for the correction. After my mention last week of GRC's forum availability, we experienced just a perfect level of influx of new members. Today, we have more than 2,800 members, and I'm completely happy with the way this is proceeding. It's easier to handle a steady trickle than a stampede, which is what I was hoping to prevent when I actually had something available for people to download and play with and then report on. So, people coming in and saying hi and getting to know the place works well. And a very nice community is establishing itself there. So I could not be more pleased. A couple of days ago, I added a "What I'm Working On Right Now" tracking thread to my personal blog forum so that those who wanted to know what's going on with me at the moment could easily check to see where I am along the way between here and having SpinRite 6.1 released. So by watching that thread in my blog forum, or as we mentioned also, by establishing an RSS feed, you just add a slash index.rss to the end of the URL, and then you'll get updates. So registration on the forum is still hidden from the non-podcast world. So those listening who are interested in grabbing their user ID of choice before I open the forum more widely are still invited to sign up. It's forums.grc.com/register. And with that, Leo, let's take our last break. I'm going to take another sip of water. I'm going to hydrate. And then we're going to talk about the mystery, maybe not such a mystery, well, but it is a little bit, of how Windows 7 continues to live on.
Might pop a little vitamin D pill while you're at it.
In the hearts, if not in the minds.
By the way, I don't know if you noted, but when the president went to Walter Reed, they medicated him with vitamin D and zinc, among many, yep. many other things. Yep. But that's a little also a little affirmation that even after you get COVID-19, potentially vitamin D and zinc could be valuable. Something you've said.
I hope they gave him a shot of like high dose D. I imagine they did. I'm sure did. Obviously his blood would have checked. He probably wasn't. He probably had like zero vitamin D.
There's no vitamin D in what are they, hamburgers?
That's true.
And well-done steak. I'm afraid not. No? Mm-mm.
Yeah, and I think we've seen pictures of him eating fried chicken and French fries on plane.
Yeah,
and, yeah, you won't get your vitamin D there either.
Actually, normally, vitamin D milk, does that have enough vitamin D in it to make up for a deficiency?
No, not really. Again, it's the RDA will keep you from dying of, what is it, scurvy or rickets?
No, rickets. It's a rickets. Yes.
Scurvy is vitamin C. Yes, yeah. Rickets. You won't get rickets, but you won't be, you won't be glad that you got COVID if your vitamin D is down
still,
at that level.
I may be taking my vitamin D, but I'm wearing a mask, folks. I'm not taking any chances, as you should, too, to protect us both. Our show today brought to you by Melissa. Speaking of vitamin D, did you know that, like milk, your customer data goes bad pretty fast? You would never forget to check the carton of milk for the best buy date. And if you do, you're threatening to ruin your bowl of Cap'n Crunch. Same thing with the customer data. Up to 30% of customer data goes bad every year. Email addresses change, addresses change, names change. Melissa started many years ago verifying zip codes, and they have over the years expanded to really cover the everything in your customer data. It's so important that your customer data be accurate for a number of reasons. You don't want to waste money sending mailers to people who aren't there. I used to get three catalogs, exactly the same catalog from Restoration Hardware, and this must have been a hugely expensive, four-color, thick, glossy pages. Sending three to the same name and address, clearly their customer data had gone bad. At the same time, you don't want to miss customers. You don't want to misaddress mail. I've mentioned already the masks, the TWIP masks that all got sent to some guy in Florida. By the way, when he shipped them back to us, because I think he got 180 of our masks, the company that had sent all the masks you all ordered to him instead of you, they had the name and they had this, I think they had the name right, but the street address in the city was the same place in Florida. We got the boxes. There's a lot of other companies' masks in there, too. It was clearly some mess up in the customer data. They should have had Melissa. They've been helping businesses maintain accurate data, fresh data, if you will, for over 35 years. Incorrect data is often not your fault. Customers misenter data, customer service reps, fat finger data, duplicated records, out-of-date records. It's easy for bad data to find its way into your mailing lists or your customer lists. Melissa can help you verify the data. Not even just after the fact, of course they can do that, but even during the point of entry, because they have a fantastic API. A lot of companies use Melissa in their customer service portals. So, and you've probably experienced this, when you start to enter in an address, you get a pop-up that, or it fills it in. It says, is this right? Or when you enter an address, it verifies it. Oh, that's through Melissa. Melissa's matching and dedupe tools help you uncover, merge, and purge hard-to-find duplicate records. You know how hard that is if you've ever synced your address book and had all sorts of errors introduced into it. Melissa's flexible deployment options mean you can use Melissa as you need to on any platform to suit your preference, your business size, or your budget. You can run it on-prem. You can run it as a web service. They have secure FTP processing, so you can FTP them a customer list, and they'll send it back to you. They also offer software as a service, so it's like it's running on-prem, but it's running in the cloud. You choose the form of Melissa that suits your business needs best. And I should assure you, because you're going to give them customer data, Melissa undergoes constant independent security audits to reinforce their commitment to not only data security and privacy, but also to fulfill strict compliance requirements. They have the utmost dedication to your data security, implementing strong controls and safeguards so that you don't have to worry about privacy. Over 10,000 businesses trust the address experts. You should trust Melissa. And by the way, they're doing a really good thing during the COVID crisis. They're supporting qualifying essential workers and communities by giving them 6 months of free service. So if you're a nonprofit, if you are serving communities, if you're essential workers, check it out at melissa.com/twit to see if you qualify for that 6 months of free service. That's really, really great. Not only do you verify everything, addresses, names, emails, phone numbers, you can even add customer demographic information, public record information like property, mortgage data, marital status, social media handles. So Melissa, if you have a partial record, can fill in the gaps, add emails, add phone numbers. And it's a great way to identify prospective customers because Melissa offers a prospect database matching your existing customers and saying, hey, here's some people very similar who would be interested. I think there's so many things Melissa could do for you. But most importantly, do not put up with sour customer data. That can really put a crimp in your cornflakes. Try Melissa's API in the developer portal. Very easy to log on, sign up, and start playing with the API sandbox anytime. Just at melissa.com/twit. And by the way, 1,000 records claimed for free. So you can see how it works. That's enough for your Christmas card list. Now's the time. Start thinking about that. Melissa.com/twit. M-E-L-I-S-S-A. Melissa.com/twit. Fresh data. It's as easy as 1, 2, 3 with Melissa. And now the fully hydrated and vitamin D'd and zinced. I got the zinc glycinate, right?
That's the one
I'm using.
Yes.
I'm taking every precaution. I really am, because I do not want to get this thing. Yeah. It gives me the willies. All right, on we go with the show.
Yeah. So, why are people sticking with Windows 7?
This I've got to hear. Really, I'm baffled.
Yeah. An interesting bit of research by ZDNet caught my eye. ZDNet noticed that these days, nearly 10% of their website's visitors were still running Windows 7 more than 5 years after the release of Windows 10. And as we all know, despite Microsoft's extreme efforts to force everyone onto Windows 10, Ed Bott, who grew up through the birth of the PC like the rest of us old timers, you and I, Leo, know Ed's name well.
Oh, he's on Twitter all the time. He was just on a couple of weeks ago. We love him.
Yep, and he's been in the industry forever.
Oh yeah.
Notice that their server logs were showing this and set up the poll. So the poll setup read, statistically speaking, this is Ed, 1 in 11 people reading this post on a PC are running Windows 7. That's not speculation or guesswork. That's what the ZDNet server logs for the last 90 days say. Some 85.8% of the many millions of PC-based visitors to this site are running Windows 10. Of the remainder, 9.2% are running Windows 7, which is twice as many as the Windows 8 and 8.1 population. That data lines up pretty closely to public data from the United States government's massive digital analytics program, which measures visits to more than 400 websites run by the federal government. Over the same three-month period, their mix of traffic from PCs consisted of 85.9, that's virtually the same, Windows 10, 10.0 Windows 7, and 3.7 Windows 8. That's a fairly significant drop from the last snapshot I looked at, which counted Windows 7's share of visitors at 18.9% in the 90 days leading up to that operating system's July 14th, 2020, end of support deadline. And then and he references an article from then. So he says the glass half full crowd says it's a good thing that half the population has stopped using Windows 7 in the 9 months since Microsoft ended support for it. He says, but I'm curious why so many are continuing to use Windows 7 past its expiration date. Rather than speculate, I put together a poll. Thanks to the more than, oh, it's 3,200, not 38, as I said. Thanks to the more than 3,200 people who responded, I'll share the results next week. Well, that was a week ago. Now we have the results. He posted yesterday on ZDNet. He said, our ZDNet poll drew more than 3,200 replies, along with 50 or so emails. The results are fascinating. Let's start with the two easiest questions. Do you plan to upgrade to Windows 10 in the next 12 months? The answer to this question was pretty emphatic. Just under 58% replied no, with another 27 answering, not sure. Only 16% said yeah. Several respondents pinned the blame for the slow upgrade on corporate IT departments, with two respondents saying that the COVID-19 response had caused issues with completing upgrades within their organization. Others pointed to IT departments that are understaffed and incompetent and taking their time.
That's so cool. Rude to say, it's because I have an incompetent IT department.
They're not that good. We all wish we had Windows 10, but we're still stuck with this old horse.
Yeah.
It says, in all, roughly 1% of respondents specifically mentioned that they were prohibited from upgrading because they were using a company PC and not a personal device. Eek. Don't you touch that. Eek. It's working just fine.
Eesh.
Okay. Next question. Are you paying for extended support? That is, has your Windows 7 support not actually ended? He says, although Microsoft has stopped releasing monthly updates to the general public, those updates are still available for those, which bugs me, for those who purchase extended security updates, ESUs. He says, they're not cheap, and they get more progressively more expensive, as we know, every year. And they're not easy for small businesses to acquire. He says, as I noted at the beginning of this year, because earlier he wrote a piece titled, you want to keep running Windows 7? Good luck with that, small businesses. Anyway, he says, perhaps that explains why only 6% of poll responders said they are paying for ESUs, with another 3% admitting they're not sure. The remaining 91% are apparently going without. And, you know, that's the camp I'm in. I'm going without. I'm sitting in front of Windows 7 right now. Works great. He said, in the longer responses, some people took pains to note that their Windows 7 machines aren't connected to the internet. Okay. Others pointed out that they had up-to-date security software. Yes. And a few said they thought Microsoft was exaggerating the threat posed by running unsupported software in a bid to squeeze more company out of customers. Fair enough. Okay, so big third question. What is the main reason you have not upgraded? Ed says, here's where things got interesting. The original survey contained four choices in a box labeled and a box labeled other, where respondents could fill in their own answers. Nearly 1,000 people chose other and then wrote in their reason. He says, I read every one of those responses and categorized them manually. About 10% of the responses could not be categorized because the reason was indecipherable or irrelevant. That left a total of 2,855 usable responses. So out of a universe of 2,855 usable responses, here's how they broke down. And this I found really interesting. 42% said compatibility. The number one reason people are sticking with Windows 7, Ed says, there's no contest. Compatibility issues, hardware and software, wins in a landslide. Fully 40% of respondents chose that answer, and another 2% or so selected other and then identified a compatibility issue. The specifics include some esoteric equipment, including one person with a legacy CNC milling machine, you know, computerized numerical control milling machine, plenty of old peripherals that don't have Windows 10 drivers, and several people who paid for Adobe Creative Suite perpetual licenses and have no desire to upgrade. He said among the write-in responses, the biggest group was made up of fans of Windows Media Center, who collectively added up to roughly 1.5% of respondents. He said their loyalty is impressive. Okay, 42% compatibility, number one. Number two, a third, 32%, don't want to upgrade. He said about 17% of respondents chose the ready-made, just don't feel like upgrading answer from the poll form. But I counted nearly the same number of people who chose the other box and then made it clear from their reply that they had picked Windows 7 over its logical successor, Windows 10. I sorted those replies into four buckets in the following order. People who just don't like Windows 10 made up the biggest chunk of respondents. People called out the user interface, bugs, and stability in particular. About 1 in 4 of the I don't like Windows 10 group used strong enough language that I created a separate Windows 10 sucks category. Many used that exact phrase, while others threw in overheated words like garbage, crap, dumpster fire, and a few choice phrases that I can't repeat here. In all, those first two groups added up to about 10% of total responses. A slightly smaller camp had no particular problem with Windows 10, but preferred Windows 7. Just under half of this group...
You influenced a lot of that previous group. Yeah. You know, Steve Gibson says it's a polished turd, so that's why. That's all you need to know. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. Anyway, go ahead. Then there's okay. Another group.
Just under half this group praised Windows 7 because, quote, it just works.
Yeah, or not.
A slightly larger group said they believe Windows 7 is better than Windows 10. They praised the user interface, quote, much more user-friendly, or the last usable version.
Yeah. You know, all of that's legit. It's not that it's not legit, right?
Yeah.
It's just that it's insecure.
Yeah, it works. It works great. And called out Windows 7 for its stability. I mean, look at what this year has been about. Windows 10 disaster after disaster after disaster.
Yeah.
My printer, I can't print anymore. It you know, I just lost all of my programs and documents. They're all gone. You know what? Anyway.
Did you feel like that's worse with 10 than it was with 7? It feels like it, but I don't remember specifically, you know?
Oh, yeah.
It seems worse.
I don't remember that with 7. No. You know, 7 was mostly sort of a refrosted XP.
Right.
So, they weren't really trying to do that much to
Maybe
it.
That's it. Yeah.
They've really gone crazy with Windows 10. Anyway, so he said a word that appeared over and over again was control, especially in the context of security updates. He says more on that in a minute. He says, in all, it seems appropriate that the two groups of Windows 10 of Windows 7 fans added up to about 7% of the survey respondents. And then in something curious, 10% said upgrade is too expensive. And Ed wrote, I was surprised that so many people chose that option, especially when the Windows 10 upgrade is free. The most poignant example came from a reader in Iran who said, in Iran, we have a bad situation, and the cost of the upgrade was too high. Okay. 5% said, updates are too intrusive. He said, an unsurprising number of people expressed their extreme displeasure with forced updates, buggy updates, and the feature churn with twice yearly feature updates. Quote, I've never had to reinstall an OS due to a borked update, said one respondent. And quote, that seems to be a regular occurrence with Win10. Continuing the theme of loss of control, another person said, I own my computer and I will decide when to update, not Microsoft. And then down at 3%, was privacy, telemetry, and spying. He says, I was just a bit surprised that this number was so low. But what they lacked in numbers, this group made up for in, well, let's just call it passion, using multiple variations of the word spying as well as privacy to express their discontent for Microsoft's telemetry, which is apparently a dirty word. Another 1% or so specifically called out the word trust, and a handful described their hatred for Microsoft using language that my editors would be extremely displeased to see me repeat on this website. And he said, perhaps the best response in this group was this one. This is an all caps big brother, comma, brother. Finally, 3% were afraid to upgrade, can't upgrade, too busy. Ed wrote, not everyone who responded to the survey was dismissive of the idea of upgrading. A significant number of people said they were afraid to upgrade because they worried they would lose data or programs in the process. This category also included people who said they were just too busy to upgrade, or that they couldn't afford the time to reinstall programs and reconfigure system preferences. About a third of the responses in this group, that would be down at 1%, said their hardware was too old to upgrade or that they had tried and failed. But my favorite reply was a single word, just in quotes, laziness. Okay.
Fair
3%
enough.
3% had training and support issues. He said, honestly, I expected this group of responses to be bigger, but it looks like like most corporate customers aren't particularly worried about users being able to adapt to change. And finally, the least frequently cited reason at 1%. But okay, so what would that be? That would be shy of 300 of the respondents said, I'm moving to Linux. And Ed said, and finally, it just wouldn't feel right if I ignored the handful of respondents. Oops, no. So less than 1%. He said 24 to be exact, who said they either have switched to Linux or just about to do so. So anyway, looking over those numbers, I was surprised that 42% cited compatibility issues. Ed mentioned some old, CNC equipment whose drivers were unsupported by Windows 10. And I think that probably we think too often of Windows systems in the generic desktop role, desktop workstation role. But for example, my dentist's office is still using Windows 7 for its patient records management, and the app that runs the digital X-ray machine and displays the digital X-ray images, I note, is hosted on Windows 7. Who knows whether that would run on Windows 10? And I'm sure they're not wondering. You know, it's a case of if it's not broke, don't fix. So even if compatibility were not an issue, it could also fall into the 32% who just don't want to upgrade. It's like, you know, it's running just fine. And one advantage of using Windows 7 for non-desktop applications, like that, the X-ray machine, is that Microsoft cannot force the system to upgrade or else. I certainly do find much to agree about with those users who say, this is my computer, darn it, I'll decide what software it runs and when. So anyway, I guess someday that attitude will be considered quaint. And I should just note, I'm now, you know, freely using two machines. Today I use Windows 7 and Windows 10 every day, a different workstation on each of my two sites. I'm sitting in front of a Windows 7 machine here. In the evenings, I use Windows 10. And what I think will eventually happen is that Windows 7 will become too old and things that I want will not be available for it. You know, that's what happened with XP. Both Mozilla and Google had refused to continue updating their browsers just because I was still using Windows XP. Otherwise, it was a perfectly functioning OS. And of course, IE had died on it ages ago. As it happens, just last night, I wanted to install the Calm Radio app for background ambient music while I'm working. The Windows 7 app is nowhere to be found. Now it's Windows 8 and 10 only. So as it happens, I ran it on iOS, which worked just fine. But you know, I'm sure at some point I will rebuild this Windows 7 machine when it just becomes too old, when the things I want to do with it are no longer available on it. And then I'll move to Windows 10, you know, and I have experience with it now. I'm using it in the evenings. And right now I've got Windows Defender, which is getting, is keeping itself current and keeping an eye on the system, and all my browsers, you know, Firefox and Chrome are both being updated, as is Edge. So, you know, I'm good for the time being. And I know, Leo, you're sort of in Linux, right? Or is that where you are now?
Yeah, Linux and Mac. I don't actually have any Windows machines at this point. I should, and I'll probably find one somewhere. But, yeah, I don't have any Windows 7.
I know what's going to happen is somebody will finally put it on some really tasty hardware that you have to have.
Yeah.
Although
I'm waiting for Apple Silicon, but there's like a new HP Elite, which they're beautiful computers. But what ends up happening is I buy the Windows machine and put Linux on it after about 6 weeks with Windows. I go, that's it. I'm done.
Yeah, I know.
I'm surprised that you've survived, but you have to, right? You have to.
Well, and frankly, the developer tools, that's the really one of the things that Microsoft really got right in the beginning. They created some world-class developer tools for Windows. And, you know, I'm for the work on SpinRite and Beyond Recall, that's still DOS.
Right.
And then soon it will be UEFI with no DOS.
Right.
But, you know, so I really do. It's just better for me to be developing on Windows.
I don't know. Emacs with assembly is pretty good. You should really consider it. I'm just saying. I know. You're still using Brief, right?
No, I had to give it up. It was 16 bits.
Oh
yeah, and I'm glad I made the switch. Although I am Visual Studio 2008, so I'm staying as old as I can.
Visual Studio is pretty nice. I actually use even on Linux or Mac. I use Microsoft's open source VS Code, which is kind of a simplified Visual Studio, and I really like it. I use it all the time. I'm using right now. I'm studying Haskell, and it's a very Haskell. The hardest thing about Haskell, the reason I've kind of turned my back on it, is the tooling is so nuts. It's just crazy. It's not anything like, you know, it's not like you write a text file and you compile it. It's much more complicated than that. And finally, the Haskell community has finally addressed that. There's a very good VS Code plugin. GHC Up is a very easy way to install it. And so, you know, tooling, I completely agree with you. Tooling is 99% of it, even I'm sure for assembler. You've got the right tools, then the job is a lot easier. Debugging, testing. How do you test? That's the other thing. Do you have some sort of test harness for hard drives, or how do you examine hard drive behavior?
So the first thing I did when I returned to this project was to create a development environment that would be comfortable.
There you go.
And so so because I'm DOS hosted, I had a weird problem with Windows 10 because the DOS Samba client, you know, Windows file and printer sharing, was so old for DOS that it didn't do the encryption that Windows 10 was insisting upon.
Oh, so it couldn't read the drive.
So I fought with that. But now what I have is I have a side-by-side or actually Oracle's VirtualBox. I'm able to bring up a VirtualBox VM.
Yeah.
It's networked into the network, so it's able to see my development directory. So I'm able to run the debugger. I'm using SoftIce, which was the best debugger back in the day. So I've got SoftIce on DOS, and so I can just hit G and enter, and immediately I'm in the code. The debugger pulls the source from the Windows directory, so I'm doing source-level assembler debugging, able to single-step and look, watch the stack and all the registers and all that, but actually running in DOS. And so some of the things I can do there, some of the actual hardware stuff, I need to use an external machine. So I have there an external box that boots FreeDOS, same network stack, in order so that it can see into my Windows directory, and then I just have a freestanding DOS machine. So, having a comfortable development environment, since I plan to be doing this full time now for the foreseeable future, that's the first thing I needed to establish.
Yeah, I would imagine. Yeah, that's another kind of
tooling.
And
it's not easy because this stuff's getting so old.
Well, then so are we, Steve. So
yeah, that's true. Yeah. We'll all fade at about the same time.
Better not fade. Keep going, Steve Gibson.
I figure I got another 20 years in me.
That's good. I like hearing that. Yeah. That's Steve is at grc.com. That's his website. That's where you'll find SpinRite. That's the product he's talking about. This is bread and butter, the world's finest hard drive recovery and maintenance utility. Soon development continues apace on version 6. And if you buy it now, is it 6 or 6.1?
We're going to 6.1.
6.1.
We're now at 6.
So if you buy 6.1 now, I don't know why I forgot that. I spaced that out. 6.1 is in active development. You get to participate in that. And, of course, you'll get an upgrade automatically, too. If you're there, check out all the other wonderful things Steve has to offer, including this show. He's got 16 kilobit audio for our friends in Australia and otherwise bandwidth impaired. He has a transcript that's unique to his site. No one else has that either. And that's really a useful tool for people who want to read along and learn from the show. I know people learn a lot listening to this show. You can also get 64 kilobit audio to his site. We have both 64 kilobit audio and video at twit.tv/SN. You can also subscribe. There's a YouTube channel if you want to watch the video only. And if you have a podcast player, you could probably subscribe there too. Security Now has been around for 15 years. I would imagine by now they would have added it to their directory. If they haven't, I think they never will. It's too late. Steve, we will see you next week. We'll be coming off the iPhone announcement. I'll actually be curious. I know you're an iPhone user. If you see any compelling new features, it'll make you want to buy it. Did you upgrade to 11?
No. I have 10.
Yeah. So yeah, this might be one you want to look at. We'll talk next week about that.
Okay.
Thanks, Steve. We'll see you next time on Security Now.
Thanks, buddy. Bye.
Hi, I'm Jason Howell, host of All About Android, where each week I'm joined by my co-hosts Florence Ion and Ron Richards, and we talk about everything that has to do with Android. Is it news? Is it hardware? Is it apps? Well, you name it, we talk about it. We invite guests from the industry on the show. We even sometimes have people from the Android team themselves talking about what makes Android so great. And you could subscribe so you don't miss anything about the world of Android by going to twit.tv/AAA. We'll see you there. Security now.